Sally regards again and yet again to guests and visitors at Nemata and, as always, to the loyal staff of student teachers. This is the main professor recording on August 1st, 2019. And this is a talk for the landing page of Course 11 in Skywatching. Following the usual procedure for Nemata, I offer an introductory talk on the course landing page. Now, the course landing page of all the 12 courses, as well as the three vocations, those course landing pages are freely available to those who sign up as guests or visitors to the site. They're not exclusive to staff alone. I like to do that so that I can invite you into the course, so that I can invite your interest and orient you, of course, pun intended, to the material that is specific to the course. So you will see, if you scroll down the bottom of the landing page, you'll see the curriculum panel, and there you'll see the designation for Block 101, which is titled the Astral Interface. The units in the blocks are available to members. The orientation talk and text on the landing page is available, freely available, to everyone who comes to the school. So there you have it. Now, where do I begin? Whew! Where do I begin to introduce you to what is presented, what is available in Nemata under the rubric of sky watching? Wow. I have to say that the enormity of the subject is pretty daunting. And that being so, it might be appropriate if I open the talk here with an outrageous act of self-indulgence. Some of you, many of you, are familiar with my occasional, I won't say frequent, my occasional outbursts of inordinate and boundless self-importance. And I reckon that such an outburst would be appropriate to introduce this material, introduce this subject matter, all that comes under the theme of sky watching. You know, sometimes I wonder if you, over there, you who listen to my words and read what I've written, sometimes I wonder if you wonder what it's like to be me. And if you ever do, let me assure you of something. Here's something to register in your mind and memory. I also wonder what it's like to be me. There are certain events, certain themes, you could say, certain topics that prompt me to wonder what it's like to be me. I really don't have anything to compare to me in certain respects. Now, on the one hand, of course, what I've just said is an indulgent statement of megalomaniac egotism and self-importance. Granted, hands up, I'm the first one to admit it. It's also a simple and obvious statement of fact. And that fact is no more clear than when it comes to this material. Over the years, fortunately, over the last 5 or 10 years, particularly the last 5 years, I've had a handful of people around me in direct physical contact to whom I have been able to transmit my skill in sky mantique. Use that term. That is the correct term. Sky watching is sky mantique, and mantique, of course, means divination. The art of divining the sky, of reading the signs and omens of the planets, and of reading the code of the constellations. That is sky mantique. And among this small group of close friends, students, and allies who have learned sky mantique from me, there are some who have made this observation. Well, John, gee whiz, it appears that you might be the only individual living in this time, who can actually read the sky in depth. And I have to say that there is probably some truth in that statement. Now, I have no doubt that there could be shamans here and there around the planet of various traditions, surviving shamans or beneficiaries of ancient indigenous shamanic traditions in Siberia, in the Ural Mountains, maybe in Polynesia, in South America, among the native peoples of North America, among the Chinese, I don't know. But I would not preclude the possibility that there are some individuals at the end of that long lineage of sky diviners who can read the sky in some manner. You know, it's a simple fact, a well-known and evidence-based fact, that a shaman was qualified to be such by certain abilities. You have to demonstrate your skills in order to be legitimately considered as a shaman. And one of those skills is, of course, to go into the Nahual, to go into the other world, and to return to the Tonal, the ordinary world. A skill of retrieving the memory of the folk, retrieving and retaining the memory of the tribe, of the folk, the phylogenetic memory. So the shaman can access phylogenetic memory circuits in the body of the planetary animal mother. The shaman can heal psychologically, mentally, emotionally, and physically. The shaman can kill, and the shaman can read the sky. I return really often to the example of the Dukpa, which is the name for the indigenous shamans of Tibet. And I think of them often due to my connection with the Tertonic lineage of the Nyingma, or the ancient ones, the old ones. You know, the Nyingma among the, what is it, four prominent sects of Tibetan Buddhism are those who are said to be most closely related and intimately rooted to the indigenous peoples of Tibet. So, among the indigenous pre-Buddhist peoples, there were Dukpas, as they were called, shamans, sorcerers, and diviners. So, I can only speculate, but I would hope, I would like to believe that there might be some sky diviners here and there around the world. But as far as I know, I'm the only sky diviner known to the world at large who talks to the entire world and teaches celestial mantique to the entire world. That's a fact. And I must say, when I reflect on that fact, I feel rather odd. Put yourself in my skin. Now, through the years, I've discussed with my students, those particular students who've had the opportunity to be with me under the night skies and over seasons and observe the celestial cycles and learn to read the celestial code, I've had occasion to discuss with them the, what shall I call it, you know, the prospect that I would give a school a course in sky divination. That is something that I would describe as highly desirable, but quite implausible. The conditions do not allow me to do this. And what would be required, the requirements for me to do that are quite extensive. You cannot teach sky divination in a weekend seminar or in a two-week course or even in a two-month course. You have to learn it in the course of the year, following the lunar cycles, following the variations in the display of the celestial constellations as they rise and set in different ways and at different angles in the sky, month by month through the course of the year. That's the only way that you can learn it. Well, how am I going to set up a one-year course in sky divination? You get the picture? Who could participate in that? Who has the time to make that commitment? And where do I set it up? In Andalusia, just a little bit north of the Straits of Gibraltar, looking out upon the mountains of Africa, I had the ideal conditions in order to do that. Ideal sky watching conditions. Ideal weather conditions. Clear skies for as much as 300 to 330 days out of the year. Impeccable skies. That condition itself largely precludes the possibility of setting up an extensive course in sky divination. So, to cut to the point here, I've more or less surrendered that notion. I don't expect to be able to do that in the remaining time in my life. That being so, I have to fall back on a provisional plan, Plan B. How can I transmit the knowledge and technique that I've acquired through my life in celestial mantique? How can I transmit it and make it available and learnable to those who are disposed to learn it? Big question. And the best I can do, I would say, is structure it into blocks, formulate it, pull it together into modules, and release those modules on Nemata. And that's the best I can do. And it all starts here with the introduction to Skywatching, Course 11, and with the release of the first block, the astral interface. Now, to complete this introductory talk, I'm just going to run over the text that I have provided on the course landing page and elaborate on some of the key points in the text, coming down to the conclusion where you see a bullet point list of the groundwork or entrance conditions for skywatching, the requirements that you must learn to enter into this genre. And I'll run through that list, and that will bring this introduction to its conclusion. First of all, I start off by pointing out that years ago when I was writing Quest for the Zodiac, actually sometime before that, that was in 1998, 1999, I faced the task of translating the Greek phrase, it's two words actually, that is the basis of the word zodiac. Now, the word zodiac, or derives from Greek, probably exists in dozens of other languages, probably exists in Japanese, in Russian. They probably say zodiac in Russian with a Russian accent. Say it in every language. It's remarkable. How many words can you think of that are repeated like that and not replaced by another word in the language in use? In other words, I would say that probably in Russian, they don't replace the word zodiac by a Russian word. They just use zodiac. What an extraordinary word. It runs through the entire spectrum of languages spoken on this planet. But where does it come from, and what does it actually mean? Zodiacos kyklos, I believe, is how you would pronounce the Greek original. And it's usually translated as belt or circle of animals. But as I show, this is not the case, and this cannot at all be the case. Also, I would have you note, and this is really important, that when you consider the word zodiacos, you find in there a cue to the Nag Hammadi Gnostic narrative of the Aeon Sophia. The word zoe, as a name, as a feminine name, appears in The Origin of the World, and I believe in a couple of other Gnostic cosmological treatises. There is an extremely unique and outstanding passage that describes an event that occurred when Sophia was outside the realm of the galactic core before she morphed into the earth, and before humanity appeared upon the earth. So this is one of those incidents in the cosmological narrative that occurs in the reaches of the galactic arms. Now, when Sabaoth had taken up the place of refuge in return for her metanoia, Pistis the Sophia gave to the mother star her daughter Zoe, together with great authority, so that she might instruct her about all the things that exist in the Ogdoad. That is the passage from On the Origin of the World that describes Zoe. Zoe is an emanation of the Aeon's Sophia. She is called in another text, in a parallel text, she is called the flame-born daughter of Sophia. When you go and look at the origin etymologically and the use and application of the Greek word zoe, you must note that it is distinguished from the Greek word bios. And here I cite Carl Kerenyi, who was a comparative mythologist and collaborator of C.G. Jung. Zoe is life force, but not just as manifested in biological, creaturely life. Zoe is everlasting, self-renewing life. Immersion in the ecstatic life force produced the psychosomatic regeneration, palingenesis, palingenesia, of the mysteries. So, mythologist Carl Kerenyi explained that Zoe is the Dionysian factor, the connection to indestructible life, contrasted to bios, which is the limited biological life process. This is a tremendously important commentary on the passage in the sacred narrative, which is loaded, of course, with Gnostic jargon, and I just explained there one element of it. The Ogdoad, or the eighth, is a mystery term for the celestial realm of the starry constellations. The ninth is a related term in the narrative. So the ninth, where Sophia abides in her correction, is the sphere of the earth, or the three-body system of the earth, moon, and sun, that is embedded in the eighth, which is the celestial realm of the starry constellations, and that is the entire picture. That is the explicit, scientifically, and astronomically accurate picture corresponding to what the narrative tells you. Got that? Now, I point this out in this introduction on the course landing page, not to be pedantic and tedious about it all. Oh, well, maybe a little bit. But to highlight the fact that being steeped in this cosmological narrative is a pre-requirement. It's a precondition. If you want to come into sky watching, you need first to be steeped in the cosmological narrative. And then you can move on, possibly. That's the prerequisite. That's the word I was looking for. It's a prerequisite to know the narrative and to know that it is an astronomical myth. The fallen goddess scenario is a star myth. When you know that, you're familiar with that, you love and enjoy that story, and you're hungry to know more about it, then you might perhaps move into sky watching and consider the actual basic requirements or learning, which I list at the conclusion of the text here. Okay, so what comes next? See, I wrote about, I cite a passage from Quest for the Zodiac, written about 1998, I'd say. And you see there that I lay out in explicit terms what are those creatures in the cycle or circle of animals. And it is most definitely clear and obvious that they are not a circle of animals. So to name them one by one by name and to give them their proper storybook or animal names, not using the Greco-Latin terms Aries, Taurus, Gemini, and Cancer, we set those aside. What are the 13 components of the star zodiac? Well, how many animals are there? Three. Count them. A ram, a bull, and a lion. Those are the only animals. So why would you call the entire zodiac a circle of animals when it only has three animals in it? Right? Continuing the inventory, there are two strictly human figures. First of all, the twins, Castor and Pollux, and they go together. So there are three, really, and the third one is Ophiuchus, the snake tamer. And then arguably the fourth one is the Virgin, but of course the Virgin is a female figure, the counterpart to Ophiuchus, the snake tamer, but it is also strongly implied that the Virgin is a deific figure. She is the Parthenos, she is the virgin goddess mother figure in the zodiac. Continuing with the inventory, you have this mysterious and difficult character called a water carrier or water bearer. Now, I've explained in several places the difficulty I had in arriving at the identity of this figure. Manitou, the Manitou, is now the established identity of this figure in the spectrum of the zodiac. Not only did I have difficulty in naming it, but I also had difficulty in drawing it, because it is one of the most ill-defined of the constellations. So I refer there to those issues. Next. Okay, you could say, by the way, that the water carrier or water carrier or water bearer is a human figure. So how many human figures do we have? We have the twins, two, Ophiuchus, three, the yogi, the shaman, the virgin, four, and the water bearer, Manitou, five. So all in all, you could say that there are five human figures in the circle of animals. Next, we get into the realm of the hybrids, the chimera. The half horse, half man is the archer. The half fish, half goat is the goatfish. These are bizarre hybrids. Are they animals? Yeah, you could say they're animals in a way. They're chimeric animals. And then you get into the realm of those creatures contained in the zodiac, which are not animals at all, but are other types of living creatures. A crustacean, the crab, an arachnid, the scorpion, and a couple of fishes or whales, you know, which are mammals. You could consider them to be mammals. But generally speaking, you don't think of a crab and a scorpion and fishes as animals, do you? Finally, there is the figure of the balance or scales, which is a mechanical human-made device. So you put all these together, just sit back and contemplate the panorama for a moment. And I believe that you might follow my lead in protesting against the translation belt of animals or circle of animals. So to replace that and to improve that translation, I propose cycle of animations. So there you go. The constellations are mythic images, to borrow a term from Joseph Campbell, a comparative mythologist whose work we will consider in chapter 14. That's not in his image. As such, they are eternal entities whose habitat is human imagination, yet they are supercharged with the power of living creatures. They are animated and animating, for they embody meaning as a higher form of vitality. So much could be said about what are the constellations, and in block 102 of Sky Watching, I dedicate the units to a more elaborate and in-depth description of what are these animations. Apart from what you see and what you can conceive when you look at the sky, what actually are, what is the presence, what can you feel and know and experience by interacting with these massive mythic images floating in the sky? So that's where sky watching takes you, if you have the disposition and the desire to go there, and if you are willing to learn the art, like any other art, if you are willing to undertake this discipline, celestial mantique. So turning to the written text, you see I've included some illustrations. One of the first thing that comes up for consideration, one of the first issues or questions that comes up for consideration in sky watching is, well, how do you visualize them? As I say in the text, the art of sky watching involves a combination of observation and visualization. Obviously, you have to go out and look at the sky at some point and learn the sky. But you also do not merely look at the sky, you also bring a visualization to what you're seeing. Now, there are various ways to visualize the constellations. And one thing that you need to know at the outset is how many constellations are there to visualize? You know how many constellations there are registered or recorded, let's say, what is the word, by the Astronomical Union? How many constellations do astronomers recognize in the sky according to the official inventory? That's the word I was looking for. The official inventory says that there are 88. That would be 88 composites of stars in the entire celestial sphere. So imagine that you are living on Earth inside a vast bubble, and imprinted on that bubble in all directions, above and below, north, south, east, west, are 88 different star patterns. However, some of those star patterns are bogus constellations. They are late inventions. They are contrived constellations that do not have any kind of mythological or mythic content. So you can eliminate, I think, about 30 of them. I think there's something like about 55, maybe, genuine, mythically based constellations. And they fall into two categories. The ecliptic constellations, of which there are 13, and the extra ecliptic constellations, which would be the remaining, 40 or so. So I believe the Ptolemaic catalog, which is the classical reference, listed 48 classical constellations, which are true constellations. And included in that group are the 13 ecliptic constellations. So the first thing you learn in sky watching is, what are the 13 ecliptic constellations and how do you find them when you stand out under the night sky? That, and the explanation of how to do that comes, of course, in the first block of sky watching. As far as the way to represent or depict or draw them, well, that's a great adventure in itself. And I would hope that some of you who have drawing talents, some of you who are inclined toward the graphic and artistic arts, would engage yourself in depicting these constellations. Now, I myself am not at all gifted in that area. I can't draw very well, and I simply don't have that graphic talent. Nevertheless, through the years, I've made an attempt to render various constellations. I have rendered the entire range of the 13 ecliptic constellations, which lie on the path of the sun, in the rim sight. So what you see in the rim sight master model are my drawings, my renderings, which to my satisfaction are more or less okay. They're okay. I could see them improved in certain respects, and I would welcome any helping hand in that regard. But here you see I've provided an example of an extra ecliptic constellation, and that is Cassiopeia. Now, if you go and you look on the internet for images of Cassiopeia, you'll see that most of them refer back to a set of woodcuts produced by Albrecht Dürer around 1520. Dürer established the iconic or archetypal images of the constellations, the pictured images that you superimpose with your imagination upon the perceived star patterns. And his icons, or his prototypes, have more or less been copied over and over again through the centuries. So when I undertook to bring the material and technique of celestial mantique into form and to codify it in Quest for the Zodiac, I worked out what I consider to be modernist renderings. I prefer a modernist rendering to a rendering by Dürer. You can go look and make the comparison yourself. What I mean by a modernist rendering or quasi-modernist is that it follows the style of line drawings, such as you see, for instance, in the work of Henri Matisse or Klimt or another another number of other modernist artists of the beginning of the 20th century. It's a simple line drawing. I find that the simple line drawing renders the form of the constellation. So here you see an example of Cassiopeia, which can be identified by a splayed W. Many people recognize this splayed W high in the sky of the northern hemisphere. It actually sits in the Milky Way. And so the rendering, the visual rendering, shows Cassiopeia sitting in the Milky Way as if in her bath. And she is immersed from the breasts downward in the waters of the Milky Way. So there are many ways to depict these figures, and I allow artistic license, but at the same time I hold you, whoever may attempt to depict them or draw them, I hold you to rigorous observation of the actual celestial patterns and actual celestial relationships. So there you see I've included a clip from an astronomical depiction, an astronomical chart showing the constellation of Cassiopeia, and you see her depicted generally as a woman in a chair facing downwards. I've reversed it, so I have her sitting upwards in the bath of the Milky Way. Finally, we come to the punchline. Well, what does Course 11 require that you learn? Well, first of all, you're required to observe the sky. But hold on, it may be that you do not have the viewing conditions to do so. I know that's unfortunately true for some of you who followed me through many years now. If you live in the cities, you have a lot of interfering light from the artificial environment, artificial illumination. So if you don't have the opportunity to easily or readily or frequently go out and observe the sky, does that exclude you from the course? Absolutely not. Remember that sky watching is an art that combines visualization and observation. And even if you don't observe, you can still work on the visualization process. You can learn to picture imaginatively what you will eventually, one day, perceive directly with your eyes. So there are two lines of study in this course: direct observation under the night sky and visual imaginative orientation, the exercise of picturing. So the material of both studies is the same, the 13 zodiacal constellations on the path of the sun, the ecliptic zodiac, also called real sky zodiac, constellational zodiac, stellar zodiac, which must be distinguished from the tropical zodiac of astrology, Aries, Taurus, Gemini, as well as from the sidereal zodiac models, such as those you find in Jyotish or Vedic astrology. And the operative tool for sky watching is the rim sight. So there you go. The written text on the landing page concludes, as I said, with a bullet point inventory of what you are required to learn for entrance into this wonderful discipline, into this vast panorama of learning and discovery that comes to you now at long last in the course on sky watching.